Accession number 15609, reel 2.
Do you know if you were attacked on the way across?
Well, if there was any scare or anything, I don't know, because I slept all the way across. And when we come off it, the Naffy girls was there, a cup of tea and a rock bun, and off you went, got in a lorry. And we went to a camp to organise, get everybody together.
What condition were you in when you got back?
Not bad at all. No, very good, because up till the time of getting the orders to come back, we lived very well. We lived partly on army rations, partly on what was on the French soil, you know. I mean, there was nothing for us to go out and get 5 or 6 chickens and bring them back to cookhouse and that off the farms, you see. So nobody objected. That was quite good. So really, exhausting was the top line of me.
Did you bring anything back from Dunkirk?
That's a laugh. I came across a Naffy van on the way up, a Naffy lorry. It was loaded up with big boxes of cigarettes, packing cases. We busted one open, it was full of cigarettes. We all filled a sandbag each. Fair enough, because they couldn't take a lorry and they couldn't take a fag, so they were there for us. So, right, we all filled a sandbag each. When I say all of us, about 3 of us. And got onto the ship, laid my head on my cigs to go to sleep. When I woke up, the cigs had gone. So that was it. I said, I didn't care. I'm getting home, so why worry? Somebody will be smoking them. Yeah, that was what happened there.
Did you get your rifle back?
Never brought a rifle home. They were shouting, keep hold of your rifle, bring your rifle back. I said, well, I'm going to lose my tank, so why am I going to bring a rifle back? So the officer laughed afterwards. He said, well, some are supposed to be paying for the rifle. He said, how are you going to go on paying for a tank? Oh, I said, don't worry about it, I'll pay it off. It was a good laugh, that. Nah. You see, there's dozens of little lads tried to swim to a boat with a rifle on their slung on their backs. Consequently, the weight was too much for them, down the wind. Duh. A lot of people lost their lives trying to carry the weapons back to the ship.
Did you see anybody killed on the beaches?
Yeah. When the Stokers and Fock Wolves come over and dive bombed us, it was murder. It was murder for 3 days. And the first day wasn't so bad, but as the Jerrys gradually got more planes to come and dive bomb, it got so you try to dig a hole in the wet sand, in the sand, you know, and it takes some doing, dig a hole in the sand to get in. It trickled in as fast as you chucked it out. But we got in the sand dunes and got sort of hid up, you know. We used to have lookouts, share a lookout between us. Here he come again, and when they machine gun you, and hope that they didn't spray your bit of beach. But I've seen some terrific things on that beach. Terrific, very terrific. Yeah.
Any other examples you can think of?
Yeah. Only the lads getting machine gun in the water from the aircraft. That was a very bad thing. I mean, they were getting wounded and couldn't carry on swimming. They'd probably get shot. They probably didn't. But there was that many bodies floating in the water after the plane went over that was practically impossible to say who was wounded, who wasn't wounded, who was drowning, who was floating. You know, it was terrible. Terrible.
Did you see any of our planes?
On the fourth day, on the third day, that's before I went to had a bit of sleep that night, when possible, there was 2 Spitfires come over and flew up the length of the beach and flew back again, you know, flew towards France or whatever. but they didn't come back again. They never seemed, well, it was, they were fighting somewhere else at the time. It never seemed possible that it could be some of our planes to arrive on the scene whilst the Jerrys come over to try and machine gun the lads on the beach. It was funny that it never coincided. But I think the Germans had very good knowledge of where our aircraft were operating. Because they used to, after the two Spitfires flew away, in come the fuck wolves and machine gun the beaches. So it's obvious that, it's funny coincidence that nobody, they didn't even meet. It was always one follow the other. That was the funny part about it. A lot of people remarked on that. There again.
What was morale like by the time you got back to Britain?
Well, it's the same old story, isn't it? If you give a soldier a cup of tea and a cake and a rock bun, he'll soon forget about the other. Give him a packet of cigs and he's all right, and he won't worry about anything else. That's a big argument there. But the morale of the lads that got back was pretty good, because after we got to Driffield, everybody got an organised 3, 4, 5 days at home, you see, you know, leave, like. And the lads that lived a long, long way away, they waited because it was possibility that we was going to move from Driffield to the southern coast ready for take-off again. But our plans all seemed to change over. And we hung on. Eventually they whipped us off to India, and then into Burma, and here we are back again.
You went to India in 42, I think.
That's right, yeah.
What was the voyage like to India?
12 weeks on the sea.
In which ship was that?
What was the name of that ship?
Was it a troop ship?
Oh, aye, it was a trooper. Yeah, it was a troop ship, yeah.
What were conditions like in the troop ship?
Cold, colossal. There were thousands on this troop ship. It was, I would suggest it were overloaded. Excuse me. I would suggest it's overloaded. Because it went to the toilet, you had to wait 5 minutes before you could get to the toilet. And things like that. But on the whole, after a few weeks on the boat, things organised and we had target practice and all sorts of things. And they had a cinema show on it, and the lads did their own concert parties and things like that, you know. So 12 weeks was 12 weeks, but there again, we landed at Bombay from there. Bombay up to up towards Pune, and then up towards the Burma coast, Burma border. And then all of a sudden they said, right, you're going up. And off we went, up to meet the Japs.
Did you feel that you'd been trained properly for the jungle?
It didn't bother me, because I was a regular soldier. And I was a countryman as well, you know. I mean, you were some of the town lads, if they was in the jungle and a flock of birds took off, they used to say, oh, look at them, man, nice. And but I used to say, right, a flock of birds took off, there's somebody scared them, you know. I had my training from being a resident in the country. I could understand all these things, but they didn't. A lot of the townies didn't know what was happening when the birds scattered and whatever, you know. But they used to give me a lot of clues. Yeah, I wasn't so daft that way. But there we go.
Where did you go to? Which company were you in by this time?
I was in the platoon, the carrier platoon, which was known as a carrier platoon till such times we had to leave our bring gun carriers at Ranikhet. After Ranikhet, we always then classed as... I was brought down to private again, because that was only a sergeant's cover, you know, for being responsible for a tank. It was promotion given to you. It was unpaid promotion and all, but it was authority, that's all. So we lost them, and I come down to private, which didn't bother me, and I mixed in with the rest of them, and gradually we got to work together. So many went to one company, so many went to another. I was in A company, and I went into C company. I went to the headquarters, I was back to C company. Cool, blimey. I think I was in A company when I went up to fight the Japs. Yeah, I was.
When you first went into Burma, where did you go in?
Cool. We went up beside the Irrawaddy River, and then we travelled along beside it, and then we had to cross over it. Cool. And then after that, we all sort of got split up. One company went in one direction, one went in another, one went in another. So in actual fact, you had a backup of one company behind you, two in advance. So you never really had the full strength in one push, you know. And you was more static in the jungle than you was going forward. We have been sit in one place for 3 days waiting for the Japs to come past us. Then again we'll push on a little bit further, and we was gaining ground, what, a mile at a time, half a mile at a time sometimes, because it was maiden jungle where you had to hack your way through. Cool. You wouldn't believe it, really. It would take you 2 to 3 hours to go 600 yards, 600 or 700 yards. And the whole point was that everybody had to follow everybody else, because those in the front were slashing, chopping. And all everybody was following, you see. So you'd relieve each other with the matchets, like machetes, chopping and that, carry his gear while he's doing all the chopping to get through. And then after a certain time, you'd have to stop, because you'd be giving your position away, you see. You'd have to stop. And then all draw the arena around where you're all stopping the night, everybody looking out each way, you see, in case the Japs approached you. There you are, that was it. Sometimes you didn't hear nobody, sometimes you heard them letting off the firecrackers about 600 or 700 yards away, you see. We used to think it was machine gun fire, but it wasn't. It was those Japanese firecrackers, but 17, 18 bangs in each cracker. Oh. Now,
where did you first run into the enemy?
Aradura Spur. You see, I've got some bits in here about that.
Don't bother with the book. No, it's all right.
Aradura Spur. Oh, I was just checking for me memory.
What happened there, do you remember?
Oh, we got into position overnight. The machine gunners were backing us up, the Manchester machine gunners. They had all their guns in position on fixed lines to fire on this bunker, to fire on the bunkers where the Japs were on the gradient that went up in front of us, and we all stayed in the valley at the bottom. Then when the daylight came, the Manchesters let off with their guns and fired and fired and fired and fired thousands of rounds into these bunkers, And then at a given time, they stopped firing and we went forward. That was when the old colonel got bumped and blah, 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 you know, and we were attacking this hill, but we couldn't get it. The Japs had the upper hand by throwing grenades over the tops. We were throwing them back again. Yeah. Every time a grenade, you'd hear them knock their grenades on their tin hats to start the striking, you know, the firing pin. And you'd hear them thump it. And you'd say, grenades, come over, pick it up, throw it back. Because they had all 10-second fuses on theirs. So, therefore, we had time to pick them up if you saw it come when it come. And if it was the same grenade as the one you heard bang. Oh, yeah. Yeah.
You said that the colonel got hit.
Yes.
How did he get hit? Did you see him?
Yes, yes. He got grenade splinters through the chest, or across his chest, and he got a bullet through the knee, the right knee. Yeah, I saw that.
How did that happen?
Because he would not get down like everybody else. He would have to stand up. He had a big Boy Scout stick like Baden Powell, and he used to say, over here, over there, there's a grenade there, and over there, and in the finish up, down he went. He was about 15, 20 yards from me when he went down. I said, will you stop down? He said, look out, there's another one, and he managed to get behind a big rock, somewhat about the size of that, you know, a dustbin. He got behind that. I said, stop there. Don't move. And then, of course, well, I had to go to the Japs with my Bren gun. Kept their heads down while the stretcher bearers got him out, you see. If somebody hadn't fired on the bunkers, they'd have popped him off and the stretcher bearers. So I had two magazines of 30 rounds each, and I give them the full 60 up the hill. And then by that time, they'd got the old man onto, they'd got the colonel onto the stretcher and was getting him down into cover. And as soon as I saw everything was okay, I turned and made a dash, because I'd no more ammunition, I hadn't got another magazine. I made a dash, and as I dashed, one of the jet bullets hit me pack and set a smoke grenade off in me pack, a smoke bomb in me pack. So I had to jettison me pack for a fair hit, causing me any damage. So there we go from there. And we all got back and got us to the corner of the road, and the ambulance has come, mobile ambulance has come up then, because they could get to the road end in the valley. They'd got up as far as there, and they'd loaded us all in, whipped us all back to the field hospital.
How long did it all take?
What, from the time I said we set off, Manchester's fired, till we evacuated the area?
Yeah.
Oh, about an hour. Less than an hour.
Could you see the Japanese?
Oh, yeah, you could see them bobbing along. You could see the heads bobbing along. You could see the helmets in the dugouts and the slits. Oh, yeah, you could see them. It was only, what, 50, 60, 60 yards away. Oh, I could see them every time you saw one. You let them have it, you know, they kept down. But unbeknown to us, they had got some escape trenches that allowed them to evacuate their front trenches by getting out without being seen. So they all took off. When we did get up there, the next day, there was nothing there, nobody. Nothing at all. Nothing at all. Absolutely bare.
So this was where you won the military medal?
Well, I presume it's because I kept the Japs pinned down while they got Robert out, which was the only normal thing to do, wasn't it? I mean, I was fine to protect myself as well, don't worry about that. But the point remains is what I did allowed the stretcher bearers to get him out plus the fact they cost the Japs a few casualties as well. But they, well, that's what you do. That's what you do. You don't think about things like that when the situation arises. You haven't got time to think. You've got to act, do it. You've got to do it then.
Who was with you at the time? When you were getting Robert Scott out?
Well, it'd be the normal stretcher bearers of our company, and there was another officer, Brown. He was there, pinned down, but he got out all right, Murray Brown. And the remainder of me, you know, me lads like me company. Yeah.
What time of day was it?
It'd be about half past six in the morning. Because it gets daylight there at 5 o'clock, you know.
What was the jungle like there?
Well, on the slope, on the Arador Spur slope, where the Japs were entrenched three parts of the way up, was pretty well vegetarian free, because vegetable free, if you know what I mean. No bushes, no grass, no nothing. That's why we had to consolidate 60 yards back in the valley. And then what we really did was made a rush attack. We was going to make a rush attack at this Arador Spur to try and overpower it, but we come unstuck. The slope was too great. The Japs had a good supply of grenades, and they pinned us down, and that was it. They pinned us down proper.
What do you think the strength of the Japanese was in that area?
In there? I should say less than 50 men. I would say less than 50 Japs in the direct front. They had a few more behind, though, because they would take off from there and dash back and join their company. I think I'd have a few more behind there.
Were you wounded at all then?
Yeah, I got blown up three times. Blown up by shell fire, grenade, ripped through the arm there, look. Bullet through the arm. Nothing serious, no. Nothing that bad, but I mean, if a person gets blown up, he's a useless person for 2 days, you know. Useless. And you see, there was no way you could have a useless person in the jungle, because you couldn't accommodate them. You couldn't look after them and do your own job as well. Puh. No way.
But when you rescued Robert Scott, were you wounded then?
Yeah, aye. Yeah. Well, as I say, when the Japs was grenading him and firing at him, and I was firing back again, I gets one through the arm. It didn't do much harm. It didn't stop me from carrying on firing. And I fired till I had no ammo left, and then I had to get out, else I'd have been laid on the deck with him, wouldn't I? Consequently, that while I'm firing to keep the Japs down, the stretcher bearers got up, got him on the stretcher. They hadn't far to go, about 25 yards, and they were under cover with him, you see. Well, that was a big thing to get him out. Once they got him out, it's okay. Then I thought, right, it's time for me to get out, because there's only me here now, everybody else is gone. So I turned around and scarpered. More or less, I head over heels down the hill and, you know, and got down behind the bushes where they were, and then they saw the blood trickling out of my arm, and all of a sheck like you do, which you are after that, and they said, right, they pinned a label on me tunic, and they said, get in the ambulance, off you go. So they took me back to first aid dressing, first field dressing, and then after that they took us back to Pune. The second time I got flown out on a Willys Jeep. A little Willys Jeep plane, which is a very small plane with a Willys engine in. You know what the Jeeps have in, the engine?
Yes.
Well, this plane had a same engine in it, and it had a wingspan of about 12 to 14 foot either side. And it could land, on a cricket pitch anywhere. It could land 30, 40 yards, maybe 50 yards can land. It can come down, hover like a bird, and then drop in. Well, we had two stretchers, one each side. And we got one lad on one side, one on the other, and I went a sitting passenger. That was four people in it, and it took off and took us back to Pune.
What did you think of the medical treatment you got?
At Pune? Excellent. You couldn't wish for better. There was a lot of... Don't forget, there was a lot of British nurses and that there. A lot of British doctors. But we got excellent treatment there, excellent. All the lads that had been flown back, broken legs, shot through the tummies and all that, you know. Yeah, hospital was full of lads.
How long did it take you to recover from your injuries?
Well, the first time it took me about a week or fortnight. Then they give you another... maybe 6 or 7 days after he says you're okay, like, give you 6 days to sort of get your bearing, and then they packed us off onto a truck, and up we went again to as near as we could get to the regiment, and then rejoined them by mule train, you know. The ambulance could come up the road as far as the road was available, and after that it was mule train. We used to follow the mule train up with the rations, escort them back to the regiment. They'd dump the what's name and bring anybody back. Sometimes two stretchers on a mule, bring the lads back that were wounded after they took the rations up, bring them back to the road, into the ambulance, and back to where the first field dressing, you see. But that was the first time. The second time I got blown up, I had 4 days in the dugout in the first field, and then they took me back by ambulance to Pune, or a field hospital outside Pune that was taking wounded, that was not sufficiently wounded, or they thought so, to go into the... Well, the hospital was full, that was it. They couldn't get nobody else in, so they set up some big marquees and... We was in there. That was the second time. I gets out of there. He sends me back to Pune for further treatment. While I'm there, he says, after about a week or fortnight, he said, well, I think you'll be all right to go back. I said, that's excellent. When can I go? He said, you're not going. And he wouldn't let me go. He said, you've had enough. You've done your bit, you've had enough. That's his words. He said, you've done your bit, you've had enough. You're stopping here. You can find a job back here. So, as you can see, I went, helped him in the kitchen, in the big kitchen, like, and the lads were very pleased. Instead of getting the food all slapped on the plates, they were getting it in nice little... what they wanted and what they didn't want, you know. And everybody was happy. But that's how I finished up.